This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government of the government love. The government of the government love. The government of the government love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney, defender of freedom, who is fresh from the belly of the beast. Yes, I mean a federal society meeting. Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
Good. Still recovering after a long day, a Liberty Pact day yesterday. So,
you know, Liberty will take it out of you for sure.
It does.
Absolutely. So Jay is running on caffeine and adrenaline here, and I think that's an awesome combination. I'm looking forward to a great show. We have a lot to talk about today. We're going to get into abortion politics, President Biden canceling even more student loan debt, Donald Trump's many trials and delays thereof, some stuff on gun regulation. And if we have time, look at how divided we are, actually, according to a new poll, and maybe even regulating table saws. Some of that will certainly go into the midweek show. We'll get to what we can here. And why don't we just get started? And Jay, in fact, why don't you go ahead and lead us off with that, with all the big abortion related news this week?
Sure. So in Tuesday last week, the Arizona Supreme Court essentially revived a 106-year-old ban on nearly all abortions. This decision will stand to turn up bring the abortion issue to the forefront, at least in Arizona. As well as there's another decision in Florida, I think that will raise the issue there. But the ruling Tuesday essentially said that, you know, when Dobbs eliminated Roe versus Wade, it also wiped out a whole lot of other statutes, leaving, in this case, an 1864 statute, which was actually before Arizona was even a state, that banned abortion throughout pregnancy except to preserve the life of the mother. So at this point, the issue is going to be before Arizona voters, who have a ballot initiative teed up that would essentially put in a pre-viability or post-viability ban, which sort of puts, I guess, in the simplest terms, would sort of put the law back to its status as under Roe/Casey. Donald Trump, actually ahead of the curve on this, made a statement earlier this week, perhaps in anticipation of the decision, perhaps just out of blind luck, that he sees abortion as being a state issue. He is not would not push for a federal abortion ban or federal abortion legislation, but rather would leave it up to the citizens of the various states to set those rules themselves. Leading to, you know, what will be sort of interesting political developments. Obviously, having abortion on the ballot is a boost for Democrats, right? Now, may or may not, how much of a boost it turns out to be for Biden, I think remains to be seen. But it infuses some enthusiasm in Arizona that might not have been there before. Likewise, would the Trump statements, now sort of backing off of any sort of federal ban, would that alienate potential right to lifers? Again, you know, it is unclear at this time, but that's where we are, Mike. So what are your thoughts? in terms of a new abortion fight now in what is an important swing state.
You know, what interests me, Jay, well, a number of things about this interest me, but one thing is that in this decision, just like with so...
Ooh, can I go back?
Oh, yeah, please.
See, I always
please
screw up the intros.
No, not
there's
at
always
all.
Like interesting stuff that I should put it there. An important point to note is the court delayed implementation of the ban for 2 weeks. And also currently Arizona's Democratic Attorney General said there will be no prosecutions under this law. And it remains to be seen whether there would be any local prosecutors who would actually be willing to try to enforce it. So it's a little bit of an also question of that now it's back on the books, and in 2 weeks will technically be enforced. But will it actually be enforced is sort of another question.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. And, so, you know,
now you can go on.
The one of the things that's interesting to me is not whenever, but oftentimes when we see courts announce decisions, the last thing that much of the media does is actually considers the decision from a legal standpoint. It's always, well, is this good for us? Is this bad for us? And if it's good for us, it's a wonderful decision. If it's bad for us, it's not. And I thought I would take the radical move, Jay, of actually finding the Arizona Supreme Court's decision, which, by the way, isn't necessarily all that easy because most of the media doesn't see fit to link to that sort
to
of
link,
thing.
Yeah.
But my God,
yeah.
We can't do that. We can't have them reading the source documents.
Why would they?
Themselves.
Yeah. Why would they not do that? Yeah.
It's like, but the thing is I wanted to look at it first as a matter of law. And I thought it was actually kind of interesting as a matter of law because you had these six justices, all Republican appointees, right? 4-2 decision. And what the majority basically says is, hey, yes, Arizona did pass this 15-week law in 2022. And it basically says that a doctor can't perform an abortion after 15 weeks. But if you read that sort of in a strict textual sense, that doesn't necessarily give the right to perform before that in light of that 1864 law. And so
right. The
majority of the court said, hey, listen, we're not making a policy decision here. We're just following what they call their limited constitutional role to interpret the law as written. And I thought that was worth mentioning, but also there were the two dissenters who said, listen, this doesn't make any sense because, as one of the dissenters said, this statute of 2022 has only one reasonable meaning and we should apply it. So in other words, this sort of ridiculous textualism taken to an extreme sort of approach. And these aren't two liberals here. And so I thought as a matter just strictly of statutory interpretation, this was interesting, at least worth talking about. And I wanted to get your take on that as well.
Yeah. So I do think the majority gets it right. And this is sort of interesting question of that we talked about yesterday at the Federal Society about at what point, you know, does interpretation or sort of viewing things and here is what they must have meant because this is the rational meaning. The only thing it could have meant, does that move from judicial interpretation to the, you know, legislating from the bench type thing? And it's sort of funny of all these, we had all the Ohio Supreme Court judicial candidates there yesterday and all of them, you know, vowed fealty to the Constitution and, you know, said they would never legislate from the bench. And all of them started with the, you know, the first place to look at any interpretation is the statute and the plain meaning of the statute. And it sort of got a little fuzzier after that, right? Everybody can agree that, you know, that's what you want to do. But it gets a little trickier when like, well, you know, what exactly do you mean by that? And in this case, I think, look, the majority gave the statute its basic plain meaning. And it says what it says. And it's one of those, this is perhaps not the, you know, outcome that maybe people thought should have happened. It might not have been the outcome some of these judges even wanted to happen, which is good, right? And I think there's something to be said about the courts not being the backstop to prevent to save the legislature from its own mistakes, or to save the legislature from doing its job. I think that's sort of a core key conservative principle, that there is this sort of, you know, a public policy interest in, look, let's have everything run smoothly. But also, I don't like the, you know, that invites that sort of so-called legislating from the bench. And I think maybe you're, you know, the citizenry is better served by a court that says, look, here we got, you know, we're stuck here. We got a mess. This is what applies. Legislature, you got to figure it out.
Yeah.
And that's yeah. essentially what they did.
Yeah. I don't think that the decision of the majority was unreasonable in that sense. But I also don't think that the position of the two justices who dissented was unreasonable. There were a few weird little things in majority opinion I would disagree with. They talked about how this was based on a reliance on the court's ruling in Roe, and Dobbs then basically changes everything. But of course, this wasn't actually enacted into law until post-Dobbs. And so that's a little weird. But yeah, I think that it's not, I generally agree with you on that. Another thing I'll point out before we get into the politics of it, well, I guess this is kind of in the politics of it, is that, you know, one simple solution, and this was suggested right after it, within 24 hours, basically, is, well, let's just do a one sentence thing saying this law, I forget the number of it, is hereby repealed. And that, boom, and the Arizona legislature decided not to do that, right? And One of the interesting arguments to me, at least, was a weird little procedural thing that really didn't get a lot of coverage. But basically, the argument was that if they had passed an immediate repeal bill, because it wasn't given a hearing in the legislature, by law, it could only take effect 90 days after the end of the legislative session. And so, in other words, if your concern was getting this on the books and in effect as soon as possible, what you'd have to do is run it through the basic process. Now, that could be sped up, but essentially the argument
And I'm not sure whether Arizona has sort of like what's called an emergency clause provision.
They do.
Ohio does.
Yeah, they do. But it has to be introduced in a certain way. And doing this sort of 24-hour thing without a hearing would not allow that to apply. And so this is one of these weird little procedural things that when you say, well, my God, why didn't they enact this right away? Well, maybe there are some reasons behind it. My sense of things is that, I don't say this a whole lot, but I agree with Donald Trump. I think they will get this taken care of. That's what I mean. Donald Trump said Arizona is definitely going to change. Everyone wants that to happen. And I think that will be the likely outcome here. So what do you think about that? Do you agree? Do we all agree with Donald Trump here?
I think that's right. It depends on how Arizona Republicans play this. I think if they play it right, yes, it'll get taken care of, and you'll end up either with back to your 15-week, or, you know, worst case scenario. I think it happens anyway. Ballot initiative to go back to post viability, and which in real terms probably is a difference of like 10 weeks between the statutory ban that was in place before. So. Yeah, I think I see this as one, it does energize Democrats. It gives them something to go to the polls about. It gets them something to be excited about, so to speak. It hurts Trump indirectly, but I think he insulated himself pretty well on this in terms of leaving some room, right, for people who would still be, look, I favor some abortion rights, but boy, I'm concerned about immigration as well. You know what I mean? I think he sort of leaves an opening for those voters.
Well, I think yes and no, because of course, right after Trump says, literally the same week Trump says, I think this should be left up to the states, then one of the states is like, oh my God, there's this complete draconian ban. And then Trump has to backtrack and say, well, you know, I didn't mean that much. And I thought he did a good job of it, because he basically has been focusing on, this is the will of the people. We want the will of the people. And I think that's a message that resonates with a lot of folks. But a rebuttal to this, and I think a very powerful rebuttal to some folks, is, listen, fundamental rights, right of bodily self-determination, as a lot of people see it, is not something that is a that it should be able to be taken away with a majority vote, just any more than, you know, right to any of other fundamental constitutional rights, essentially, which is why a lot of folks had a problem, of course, with Dobbs and overturning Roe.
I was going to say that would have been a really good argument to make before Dobbs, but.
Well, it's still a good argument if you just argue that, well, the court may have ruled, but the court could still be wrong about that. And oh, by the way, in our state, we certainly are not bound by, you know, we can increase those rights in
Correct.
Our
you
own
could,
state.
You could create rights as a matter of state constitutional law or state statutory law.
Exactly.
Which is essentially what they're seeking to do here. So, no, I don't disagree with that. I guess I was just disagreeing with the parlance of fundamental rights.
Sure.
You know, as the 14th Amendment meaning versus a fundamental right. You're thinking sort of it's a natural law type fundamental right, and therefore ought to be, if it isn't in the federal constitution enshrined in state constitutions.
Yeah, exactly.
And it may well be. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I agree that I don't know how much this is really going to hurt Donald Trump. Certainly it helps Democrats in Arizona, obviously a very tight state, one of the six or so states that are going to decide the 2024 presidential election. But one person I think it will almost certainly hurt is Carrie Lake, who has a history of saying some weird, bizarro things. But here's somebody who said, you know, in 2022, when she was running for governor, said that 1864 law was a great law, right? And now it's like, well, I didn't actually mean, I meant that in 2022, but not now. And so I think this potentially helps Democrats more in that race than anything else, right? Because
although for her part, she said that she wants to see, you know, something worked out, that this gets
right. But except you can just go back and have her saying, listen, this is a great law. And she, her campaign said, when asked about this, said, well, she didn't mean that one. And then they came back and said, well, she actually referenced it by numbers. Like, oh, well, you know, but so I think it helps a little bit on the margins.
Well, but yeah, no, I think it helps on the margins. And maybe there's a 30-second ad to be had in there. But at the same time, if she signs a redo or repeal or whatever, I mean, that ad may lose a lot of its punch.
Sure. Well, and of course, Lake is in no position to do anything at this point, right? But except say, well, I didn't mean what I said at that time, and we'll see what happens. But in general, I think the conventional wisdom on this is correct in that this is, to the extent it helps anyone, it helps Democratic turnout. It energizes folks on that issue. And that's almost certainly, if people are going out to vote to try to advance reproductive rights, advance access to abortions in Arizona, that's almost certainly going to help Democrats more than Republicans.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, to me, it here's what it does is it, and this is sort of what you said, but I'll say it better. you know, look, there were, to the extent there were concerns that there were Democrats who were just not excited about Joe Biden and might stay home. This gives them something to go to the polls for. And while they're there, they may well cast a ballot for Biden.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's what I meant. But you're right. But it's an indirect, it's a turnout effect as opposed to a direct boost.
Yeah. All right. So why don't we move on to our next story here? And that is that the Biden administration this week announced another student loan forgiveness plan. And that continues the administration's efforts to basically forgive as much student debt as it can. This is after the Supreme Court struck down their $400 billion forgiveness plan all in one sort of thing last summer based on the 2003 HEROES Act. And that ruling by the court led the administration to say, well, how can we essentially get around this, right? Or at least do this in a way that's constitutionally okay as far as a majority of the court's concerned. And it's resulted in over two dozen executive actions at this point. And if you take the cost of all of those together, which it can be difficult to do because there's a lot of, you know, various factors and assumptions built in. But there's one analysis that I found from the Penn Wharton budget model. They peg the total cost at this point at somewhere around $559 billion in forgiveness. That's $475 billion for all the previous actions or proposed actions in this latest proposal. They figured would add in around $84 billion to that. And this time around, the focus is on a number of things, including accrued interest, borrowers who are still paying after more than two decades or 25 years for graduate students, people who are enrolled in low-value career training programs, people experiencing financial hardship, and anyone who might be eligible for relief but hasn't applied for it yet. And this time around, the legal authority the administration is citing is the Higher Education Act of 1965, which allows the Secretary of Education the general authority to modify, waive, or release loans. And if you're curious about where that is, it's in Section 468 if you're playing along at home here. And then when I thought we were all done with student debt forgiveness for the week, Friday they throw another one at us, not much in the grand scheme of things, just another $7.4 billion. And so that brings the new total, again, if you're keeping track, to somewhere around $566 billion. So, Jay, I thought we'd start again with the law and with the legal authority, which oftentimes just seems to be swept aside as being unimportant for whatever reason. So let's start there. What do you think about the administration's legal authority to do this in the first place?
I was and I remain skeptical. I'd say I'm probably more skeptical now. If they thought the education secretary had the power to do this unilaterally that had been assigned to him by statute, if they thought that was their best argument, they would have gone with that instead of the HEROES Act. So I think that, you know, the idea that one, these loans are essentially assets of the United States, right? And I think you could make the argument that sure a Secretary of Education could be empowered to make changes and tweaks to repayment schedules and so forth. He does not have the power to eliminate, you know, writ large, these big swaths of debt. That is an issue for Congress. And I think this, you know, whether you call it, whether it falls under, you know, major questions doctrine, whether it's a, you know, improper delegation, you know, a delegation of improper delegation of congressional authority to an administrative official, I think there's the administration has a legal problem here. That said, what it does have in its favor is how long it would take to get that legal process moving. And on the same issue that it had in the last student loan suit, is finding a plaintiff who's got standing to sue.
Yeah. And now I think in I believe it was Missouri, their argument was that one of the servicers, Mohila, essentially had, because they would be deprived of those, the fees that they
essentially
would get,
the funds that they would have been paid for servicing those loans.
But I think they'll be able to find standing, at least for some judge. And I think there'll be some friendly judge who'd be willing to issue a nationwide injunction, because that's what judges do these days about district court judges.
I'm skeptical of the nationwide injunction.
I'm going to argue a counterpoint as a matter of law, because, you know, when we were talking about that first story, the Arizona Supreme Court, and you said, and I agree with you, that, hey, it shouldn't be the job of the courts to bail out the legislature when it does something dumb. And I agree with that. And so I pulled up the Higher Education Act of 1965, which it seems like a whole lot of the reporters covering this story couldn't be bothered to do, I guess. I don't know. And I read through it, and I found that section, which I mentioned, 468. And it didn't say, it just says that the secretary has the general authority to waive or forgive. It didn't say, unless the loans go up to this much, that doesn't say that the secretary can't do this en masse. It doesn't say anything like that. And so I agree with your prior logic saying that, well, okay, Congress maybe should have done that. And just like the Arizona legislature could put in a one sentence thing saying, we hereby, you know, repeal this 1864 law, the United States Congress could pass something saying, well, we amend this to say up to a certain dollar amount or up to some certain percentage of borrowers, but they didn't do that. Maybe that was a mistake, but hey, it's not the court's job to legislate from the bench and basically fill in blanks that maybe Congress shouldn't have left blank. And I think that logic applies here as well.
So I would respond by saying, one, I think it's good you read the statute. I think that's a good place to start. Oh, there was a wonderful one of Supreme Court candidates yesterday who said, oh, obviously the first place that any analysis needs to start is with the text of the statute itself. But before I get to the text of the statute, these are like going on from there. But my argument would be this is not an issue of Congress left something blank. It is that perhaps Congress delegated a power that it is unable to delegate under the Constitution.
Okay. And that's a different, right? That's a, that's a different issue.
Yeah.
And I think in part, a way to get around that, because of course, the question of whether
most people follow me, but what I'm saying is it's not that the statute is unclear or doesn't provide that authority. The statute, certainly, we can say purports to provide that authority. The question is that statute, is that a constitutional delegation right. of that authority? Is the statute constitutional?
And so to be clear, this would not be a question if the Secretary of Education said to any particular individual, John Smith, saying, you know, I'm going to forgive John Smith's loan because I can point to that. And that wouldn't be a question of improper delegation. It's a question of, if I'm understanding your argument and arguments from a lot of people on the right correctly, it's a question of whether or not just the secretary just doing this to an entire class of people without.
Yeah, this is similar to the DACA, right?
Right.
Right. The idea that, look, you have prosecutorial discretion, right, in order to prosecute someone or not prosecute. So it's one thing to say, look, I don't think this is a great case. I don't think justice is served by going after this person for this offense at this time, given the resources we'd have to expend, the interest of justice, you know, yada, yada, yada. This just doesn't make sense, as opposed to saying we are simply not going to enforce this law. You know, it's a matter of prosecutorial discretion. And like in this case, I would say the secretary says, look, you know, John Smith's completely broke. He's underwater. He owes the IRS millions of dollars. We're never going to see a penny of this. It's not worth our time pursuing this. You know, we would spend more chasing the debt than we would collecting it. You know, we should forgive this one.
Yeah,
that I think you could say, yeah, that seems to be something that ought to be in within the discretion of the secretary. But it's something else to say Congress gave the secretary discretion to just choose not to enforce the law at all if he chooses to.
Right. And this gets into this issue of the major questions doctrine, which essentially, just to refresh everyone's memory, is that this idea that if an executive agency tries to do something of major national significance, it has to have clear congressional authorization to do that thing. And it can't just be saying, well, we weren't told we couldn't do that thing.
Right. Can I say the line? Can I say this?
Go ahead. Line? Please do.
Congress does not hide elephants in mouse
there
holes.
There you go. There you go. Now,
the idea being, and that actually wasn't, that's sort of where sort of the major questions doctrine kind of evolved from that idea. There was more of a Chevron-y type discussion, but the idea being, if Congress means to give vast sweeping power, it does so very explicitly. Now, and you might have a good argument in this case that say, well, look, the statute's pretty clear; it says he can do it. But I think the argument is different. That say, well, you know, if you are giving someone wholesale, there's an administrative actor have wholesale authority to just say, I'm waiving that statute, right, for everybody.
Right. It's not an unreasonable question to raise. And I would say that, well, if you're going to be a strict textualist about it, you would say, well, yes, in fact, which is why I have problems with this sort of major questions idea, that because it, in a sense, at a certain point, it asked the court to say, well, what's of major national significance? What is sort of a wholesale, just, you know, what are we talking of? What's the, at what point does this animal become an elephant?
Is that the number?
What's that?
84 billion.
I mean, well, but that's my point. Is that?
Or no, it's more than. I'm sorry, it was 500 billion.
But it becomes a judicial. It becomes a judicial determination. And so this is where it gets tricky, because part of what the Biden administration is doing is saying, okay, we'll just do this in a number of smaller things that might add up to that, but none of them individually is of major, reaches that major point. And so can the court say, well, okay, this thing in and of itself, but yeah, we know what you guys are doing and you can't do that. Well, no, because then that essentially takes this unelected, I mean, it makes it even less democratic and even more problematic. And it's just an invitation to the worst sort of judicial activism. And so that's where it becomes problematic. You say, okay, you don't hide elephants in mouse holes, but do you hide, I don't know, pit bulls in mouse holes? How big does it have to be? And should the court be in the business of determining this? I would say no, which is why I think the major questions doctrine is just hugely problematic. And textualists especially should not be a fan of this sort of thing, which just invites judicial activism.
I think there's a good argument to be had that the major questions doctrine invites judicial activism. In some ways, it was sort of, you know, announced to protect against administrative activism,
sure,
right? To protect against something that you and I have bemoaned a whole lot of times, where Congress over delegates, right? And just says, okay, you know, agencies, do whatever you think you need to do to fix this problem. We're not actually going to be on the record, and that insulates Congress politically in terms of they don't have to get into the weeds, they don't have to make tough decisions, and if the agency comes back with something that's, you know, they don't like, they can say, well, geez, obviously we didn't mean that. So the major question really kind of comes down more than it's more like a variation on the non-delegation doctrine. Right. And I think that's sort of the issue we're.
Well, I think, yeah. And I think from a conservative standpoint, I feel like the argument is, well, if we're going to err, we should err on the side of less government activism, because this almost always is going to involve government doing something big. And so, yeah. And so I understand how you can say it's both, in a weird way, it's both deeply conservative in its base, but it's also in a weird way deeply activist, or at least invites that, yeah, activism.
But again, a big part of the Constitution is determining who's going to do what, whose lane is whose. And I would say one of the big general principles is that spending money is the province of Congress, right? Allocating funds, and in this case, what you're essentially doing is, you know, if you're looking at the U.S. Treasury balance sheet, you're reducing it by $500 trillion, by people that no one has voted for.
Except, of course, arguably
you could say voted for the president. But again, this seems to offend the, as I often say, the Whiggish principles of conservatism.
But,
right.
But I think one problematic aspect of this is that, well, the court can't rule on a series of laws, right? It has to rule on a specific, yeah, case. And so, for instance, let's say that this would never happen, crazy example, but let's say that the Secretary of Education did these waivers individually, right? So, right, you know, just wrote,
yeah, we're not
going to
collect, like, from this guy, not going to collect for this guy. Yeah, he's just signing the things. Yeah,
exactly. And so that it would be hard to argue against that, because it'd be like 30 million or more individual cases, right? Yeah. But the court couldn't just take them all at one. And so this is the reason for the administration's strategy here, obviously, in part. And so that makes it difficult when you can say, well, it sure does seem like the Biden administration, if you're a conservative, is trying to game the system. And I may not like that, but oftentimes, like, if to take another example from a story we're going to be talking about in a little bit here, Donald Trump and delaying trials, like, well, I may think that he and his lawyers are gaming the system, and I don't like it, but that doesn't make it illegal or unconstitutional. It just pisses me off.
Yeah, there's a difference, though, between Donald Trump gaming the system in his personal trials, right?
Sure.
Yeah. And the president gaming the system to do something that he is arguably not permitted to do under the Constitution.
Well, yeah, but that's my point, is that my argument would be that he is permitted to do it under the Constitution in certain ways, right? If right. Again, the secretary doing 30 million of these individually be okay. Now, would it be okay if the secretary did?
I would disagree on that point. I think that, the courts at some point have to look at what the reality of the situation is.
Well, let me put it this way.
You can't just say, well, we didn't really do, we did 20 million individual.
Well, let me put it this way, there was not necessarily always a legal remedy for things that may be gaming the systems. And sometimes the appropriate remedy is a legislative remedy.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
And so I think this would be an example of that. I think the Biden administration has been very, very thoughtful, in my view, or you might say on the right, very crafty, right, in how they've done this sort of thing to try to insulate themselves from the rationale that the court propounded in 2022 when they said, hey, you can't do this all at once in one big chunk, major questions, that sort of thing. But that aside, looking at it as a matter of policy, I'll say what I've said before is I'm not crazy about this. I think it's a bad idea in general as policy. If you're gonna spend or fail to collect whatever $500 billion or more in relief, I'd like to see it much more targeted, right? But the problem with that is it would require specific congressional
targeted to people I want to vote for.
But to me, even politically, these are already people who are largely in Biden's camp, right? College educated folks, that sort of thing. But to me, it just isn't ideal because it's not targeted to people who could best use this sort of relief. But again, it's one of these issues of do what you can with what you've got where you are. It's often attributed to Teddy Roosevelt, actually. TR attributed to this, one of his friends, that sort of thing. But the point being is that I think that's why the administration is doing it, saying, hey, we want to get this relief out. This is the only thing we really can do, given the authority we believe we have. Yes, we'd rather rewrite the tax code, but we need Congress to do that. And they're not going to go along with that sort of thing. So I'm not crazy about it, but I think, hey, you do what you can with what you've got where you are.
Wow. So I'm trying to think of who said this first. I mean, I want to say it was H.L. Mencken, but I could be wrong. So someone can correct me. But if it's sort of a political axiom that if you rob Peter to pay Paul, you can always count on Paul's support. And I think there's something to that. You say, well, these folks are already in Biden's camp. Well, yeah. And he wants to keep them there. So I think that's it. My bigger issue, right, is, and this is something that I think the Biden administration needs to take a look at. I mean, it won't, but inflation ticked up, right? Our last measure, and the Fed's holding off on interest rate cuts. And here we're talking about essentially, plugging an extra, over time, right? But it's still $500 billion into the economy. That's I think economically bad policy. Setting aside the whole moral hazard piece, the cost of college piece, all of those things, right? Because what happens when people think they can take out student loans and those student loans will be forgiven? What will colleges and universities do? They'll do exactly what they have been doing, and that's they continue to raise prices far in excess of inflation on the idea that, look, it's these people are all playing with free money. The colleges and universities will keep the cash. And the government will write off the rest. So I think there's, from a policy perspective, I would say it is, as Donald Trump might say, a total disaster. So,
well, I take issue with a few of those things, but let's start with the issue of how much of a cost this is, because you're right. It certainly does impose a cost, but you can't just simply take that 500, whatever billion dollars and say that is the cost, because there are arguably benefits to relieving people of debt, right? Because relieving people of some of that debt allows them to be more entrepreneurial, to go into more careers, to create more things in various ways that actually can have positive economic benefits. And so those benefits are not zero. I think you would agree those benefits are not zero. And so while I agree with you that there is a cost, there are also benefits, potential benefits to relieving people of debt.
I'm not, I buy that a little bit, but isn't there also an issue of, I mean, we had this, you know, during the pandemic and then the immediate aftermath of this idea of, well, look, you know, people don't have to pay rent. They don't have to pay their college loans. There's stimulus checks flowing. So did we see a benefit from that in terms of economic growth? Were there new businesses being created, new jobs being done, perhaps new poetry being written, whatever it is, right? There's always this idea of like, look, if I didn't have this debt to pay someone, I would go do something great. And perhaps some will, but well, my sense is there's also
But isn't that also the logic, the conservative logic behind tax cuts, saying that, hey, you know, instead of giving this money to the government, which is just going to waste it, it's better this money be go into the economy, be invested for, you know, entrepreneurial activity and all that. It seems to me it's the same sort of logic. And if it's going to apply to tax cuts, then it should also apply to this other source of money that the government's all of a sudden not going to get. I mean, how are those two things different?
Because one is money the government's already spent for your benefit, right? It's not a matter. I mean, I may have an obligation to pay taxes, but student loans are by and large a choice. And if someone says, well, okay, I'm going to take the government's, it's sort of like student. If you want to look at it this way, it's almost like a preemptive tax cut, right? But it's not necessarily even justified by the wages that you're getting. Maybe let's put the income being generated, right? Taxes take a portion of your income. This is simply saying we're going to give you some income that is not taxable. It's almost the difference between, say, a, you know, refundable credit and
I say deduction. We've given you something and we're not going to pay it back. Or really, we've given it to you so you can give it directly to an institution and you don't have to pay it back. That's a reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, this, if you look at it, it is more just a, this is a direct transfer of wealth from, you know, you can even take the student out of the equation, right? It's sort of a transfer of wealth from taxpayers to colleges and universities.
Yeah. And see, to me, I feel I have a big problem with the government in general in the business of guaranteeing pretty much any student loans. What I would love to see is, and this will never happen, but I would love to see this sort of, I guess, kind of a grand bargain thing that would get the federal government out of the business of subsidizing all student loans and just say, listen, let's cut out the middleman. Let's just support public higher education in the states. Maybe that's block grants. Maybe that's more specific stuff through direct support. I think that would be much more efficient. It wouldn't saddle individual students with this debt. And I think this would be a much better system. It'd bring us back to something more like we had when, well, states individually were supporting public education, higher education at much higher levels prior to especially the financial crisis of 2008, 2009. And so that would make it more affordable right at the front end to students. And I think also it would make an important distinction between public education, which I think government should be supporting, and private education, which is fine. Hey, if you want to go to some private institution, that's great. Both you and I, you know, went to a private institution for our undergrad. That I don't think the government has any necessary, you know, role in supporting that decision when you and I could have easily gone to, you know, Cleveland State or Ohio State or something like that. And I think a better case can be made for public support of public institutions.
Fair enough. Again, that doesn't I think you still end up with sort of the same problem of those institutions will soak up all the funding they can from the federal government, state government, whatever, and then we'll charge students tuition.
That's not necessarily
again,
true.
I mean, again, I've seen this every, you know, when I was working in the legislature, we would have the colleges and universities come to us and they would say, hey, we need this money. And we allocate the money. And, you know, there was always the caveat, listen, but you can't raise tuition by more than, you know, X percent. Absolutely. Absolutely not. We're not going to do that. Here's the money. Great. And then they're back and say, we need to raise tuition. and or they do lose sneaky stuff, like they're not raising tuition, but they're raising fees and all this other stuff to capture this money. I think that's part of a problem is when there's money flowing, there's these sort of spongy kind of institutions that will suck it up no matter what. Maybe they use it for good stuff. Maybe they don't, maybe use it for bad stuff. But the problem is it's not market. There's no market discipline to it, right?
Well,
the money's flowing.
Yes and no.
And one other thing, this is just, can I share this funny anecdote? Because yeah, it's sort of this. I remember this was after, it was my senior year, and I had gotten, into our alma mater, Baldwin Wallace, and had been given a fairly decent financial aid package. There's a program that is, I think it still is, in Ohio, where it does provide some sort of subsidy to students attending private schools. And it's not much. I mean, I think back in the day, it was something like $500 or something, right? But so I got this letter from BW saying, listen, congratulations. You know, you're getting this extra state money to the tune of $500. You know, that you might want to, we're reducing your student aid package by $500. You might want to contact your state representative and thank them for this. the irony of one, they thought I'm stupid enough to, you know, no, you contact the state representative and thank them. But to me, that's often how it works, right? It's not a matter of, does the price actually go down? No, it's just that there is now a different pay or a different transfer of funds.
But it's also, I think there's this mistaken view that most institutions are like Harvard, Yale, these other like super rich places that are just soaking up this money and have multi-billion dollar endowments, and everyone's got all the faculty have the wood panel offices, like you saw. I mean, in most cases, I mean, it's just not that way. These are places, most higher education institutions are struggling to get by and to compete.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And
yeah.
So it's when you say, well, these places are soaking up this money, it's a matter of, well, what do we need to do to compete? I know at NKU, we struggled mightily to be cost competitive and to work on that basis. And so it's not like we were just saying, well, you know, we have this massive slush fund thanks to government funding. That's not really how it works at the vast, vast majority of higher education.
No, and I think you're right to some extent there, but I would also push back. I think in a lot of cases, I mean, our alma mater, BW, has got financial issues. Cleveland State has financial issues that were just announced, significant. And part of that, it turns out, you look back, there was some significant sort of mismanagement over the years. The other piece of it is that something like college enrollment is highly, 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 almost entirely attuned to demographic changes. And colleges, if they're not anticipating those, I mean, part of the problem is they're just fewer kids going to college because there's just fewer kids. And that changes the equation. And you have, you know, colleges that build out more facilities and thinking that they would have this, but there's just the pool of fish just isn't that big right now from the demographic standpoint of, you know, how many kids. I mean, we have issues. You see this in K-12, where in our city, there's always fights about, well, we're going to have to close one of this elementary schools or something. Not because there's anything wrong with it. Not because isn't a money issue. Well, sort of. But the problem is we don't have the kids, you know, that we did 20 years ago, 30 years ago to support that or require that.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that's something. And I think it's something it's not taken into account a lot of times by college administrations. I'm not saying that everybody's living high on the hog, although I think there's arguments can be made, some are, but every other business in the world, I shouldn't say every other business, but have to adapt to changing times, changing demographics. And I don't think college and university should be any different.
No, and I certainly agree. And they are struggling to do that. And because, of course, as public institutions, but they're also different from K through 12 because they actually compete for students in a certain, in a way that most public K through 12 institutions don't. And so it's this weird kind of mixture of market-ish competition with, like you said, very little transparency on pricing. It's really difficult because, and also it's a product that you can choose not to, you know, not to partake in, whereas K through 12 are pretty much, well, yeah, I got to go to grade school and high school, at least up until what, like 10th grade or something like that. So it's a little bit different, and it is very tricky to navigate these waters. But I guess you and I don't disagree on some of the fundamental problems. We just maybe more disagree on how to address those. And I feel like more government funding specifically focused on public institutions in exchange, because it always comes with some strings attached, and it should, in exchange for greater accountability on things like pricing, transparency, and maybe even decisions about sizing and other things like that, I think that would actually make for a better, more responsive, more efficient system than this kind of mess we have today where the federal government says, yeah, you want to go to college? Sure, we'll take out whatever you want and we'll guarantee it. And maybe you'll have to pay it back and maybe you won't. Let's see what happens.
Right. But the colleges will get the money in the meantime.
Yeah, exactly. That's not
I mean, the other, as you point out, state funding is typically something that colleges would like, but gosh, what happens when the state says, sure, we'll provide you a whole bunch more funding, but you know what? We're not paying for the further expansions to your DEI programs. The wailing and gnashing of teeth, right? I mean, you can, it's audible from where I'm sitting right now. And you can look at the extensions of college expenses and how much you can certainly attest to this, right? How much growth there's been in college administration versus how much growth there's been in, you know, faculty.
Sure. And in part, that's driven by a lot more regulatory requirements and various things that, well, probably the people of our generation would call coddling. And in some instances, maybe that's true. And maybe that's, you know, maybe that's not. But there's certainly an element, I think, there's arguably an element of truth to that. So, yeah, it's become a much more complex regulatory environment. There are a lot more student services. It's a very different world from even 20 years ago or so, and a more expensive one for that reason. But all right, well, you know, Jay, I think we have time for one more. I don't want to move this over into the midweek show just because I think it's pretty timely and pretty important, especially because as Donald Trump himself put it on Monday, he is going to be something like it's bound and gagged or something like that in court. The picture he painted on Truth Social was a lot of fun there, or not fun exactly, but he does have a trial that's going to be, he said, on Monday, I will be forced to sit gagged before a highly conflicted and corrupt judge who hated me, whose hatred for me has no bounds. So why don't you kind of update us on what's going on with all that?
Well, there's not a whole lot to update other than what you just said, right? Trump had sought to a continuance of his upcoming trial that is scheduled to start Monday. That was denied, and he will start trial. And this is on the hush money case brought in New York City by City Prosecutor Alvin Bragg. So, on the one hand, from the legal standpoint, this isn't anything new or exciting. It's, you know, it happens every day of someone says, oh, I want a continuance. And the court says, no, you got a trial date, you're going. You know, and look, I've seen and heard a whole lot worse of bases for continuances other than, hey, I'm running for president. So, you know, I get it. If I'm Trump, I think he has absolutely, you know, it plays, you know, particularly into his narrative, right? Assuming that he's going to not get the continuance, he seeks it. And court says, no, I told you, here's the trial date. And then he can say, well, look, this is totally unfair. Look what they're doing to me. He gets another day in the news cycle complaining about the unfairness of it all. And I think Democrats then are starting to realize that maybe this plan to push Trump to the forefront in primaries by all these trials and indictments, you know, might might be backfiring. And look, because I think, you know, on the merits of the hush money case, I think this is probably the, well, second least meritorious in my, the first one being the recent Letitia James, the financial fraud one. But this is a close second to, I think, least meritorious.
And to refresh people's memories on that, this is 34, I believe, counts of falsifying business records. And what makes it a felony is that it was arguably being done, or the indictment says, with the intent to conceal or to commit another crime. In this case, it would be a campaign finance issues violating, or sorry, mischaracterizing the payments for income tax purposes, at least. And so the idea is that, well, Trump told Michael Cohen to make these payments, but they didn't want them to come out as well on the check line, hush money payment to porn star or Playboy Playmate, right? Because that would not look good. And so it was done in a different way. And also to refresh people's memory who might not recall this, the prior Manhattan DA, Cyrus Vance Jr., decided to not pursue this. In fact, in the office at the time, it was called the zombie case, because it just didn't feel like, he didn't feel like there was enough there, that it wasn't a winnable case. But then Alvin Bragg became the Manhattan DA, and he actually thought there was enough there and was able to get an indictment and kind of move forward, essentially. And so that's kind of where we're at with that. So it's...
Yeah, and I have, again, doubts of the whole idea of is that falsifying business records? And the weird theory behind this whole case is sort of essentially, it's a flip on the John, oh gosh, I've lost my, again, it was late night last night, Mike, former senator, North Carolina, South Carolina.
This idea that,
you know, he should have reported his hush money payments.
Oh, John Roberts, yeah.
As a campaign contribution,
John Edwards,
to himself for a campaign payment as opposed to a personal expense. I think it could be both, and I think this is a really weak case, and bringing it into a felony is even weaker, right? There might even be some grounds for a misdemeanor claim, but
so it's not. I don't think. Well, there aren't too many people who I think seriously, well, maybe there are some. I don't seriously question the notion that Donald Trump said to Michael Cohen, hey, listen, make this go away because this won't look good in my election in 2016. And so Michael Cohen went ahead and did that. I think it's sleazy. I think it's, you know, certainly not very transparent, but I don't know that it's a felony and it's a stretch. We talked about this when it first came out. And I think certainly a lot of folks on the left say, listen, we would really like to get any felony conviction before people start voting. So we can say, Donald Trump, convicted felon, do you want to vote for a convicted felon? And for a lot of low information swing voters, they might say, well, you know what? Convicted felon. Yeah, that's a bridge a little bit too far. They're not going to really look into what the felony is. But if you can say convicted felon, that's a potentially big deal with the small number of people who might make up the difference in the election. I think that's the push, at least from a lot of folks on the left, to make this happen before the election.
Yeah. And I think they miscalculated. And I think the analysis, you know, in a lot of those polls, they said, well, would you vote for so-and-so Donald Trump if he's convicted felon? And everyone says, well, no, no, no. But I think there's this asterisk there that says, if you know that, you know, convicted felon, and you know the asterisk line would read, you know, convicted in a fair trial based on, you know, real law, that sort of thing.
So I don't think so. I disagree, because I mean that's the whole point. Sure, you can, it's easy to get an indictment, but to go before a jury and get a conviction, that's a whole different thing. And that's why there's a huge difference between saying indicted, because that's just the government against Donald Trump. Yeah. But convicted, it's like, well, you know, 12 honest men and women, well, they decided the government did have enough of a case. And that changes things a lot, I think. And maybe not for people like you who are, you know, sophisticated observers of the law, but to the people we're talking about here, a lot of voters are not going to make those fine distinctions. They're just going to, they'll say, well, yeah, convicted felon, and not going to say, well, yes, it was a Class E felony. People are like, what the hell is Class E felony? So I think that's a, that's an important difference. But I'll say that what troubles me is this push to get it done before the election, because, and this is maybe in a more significant case, going to the documents case, right, which has also been a focus in this last week or so. Judge Cannon, there's this idea of issues with jury or proposed jury instructions, asking for them about the Presidential Records Act and all this. And there's been, without getting into the really nitty gritty of that, there's certainly been a feeling for a lot of folks on the left that Judge Cannon is kind of in the pocket of Donald Trump, if you will, and is doing her best to delay this trial until after the election. And so presumably after January of 2025, where if Donald Trump wins, he can make this go away. And I get that. In fact, I was listening to the New York Times. They have one of their podcasts, The Daily, I think it was, where they didn't come out and exactly say this, but it was practically just that the innuendo was just so incredible.
But we want to hang him now.
And here, I get that. So I'm going to both defend it and attack it. So to defend that, I think it's right to feel like, well, if in fact this person has convicted a felony and or multiple felonies on serious charges like the documents things, like the January 6th thing, and the voters don't have a chance to weigh that in making their decisions, and if he wins, he can make this go away, basically. Yeah, that is cause or concern. But on the other hand, I won't say I'm sympathetic, but I'll say that if I'm Judge Cannon, it's like, well, I want to be really careful about this because, well, a special counsel appointed by the attorney general of the president running for re-election is bringing really serious charges against that president's opponent in the election. And so, of course, there's not two sets of laws, one for presidential candidates and one for anyone else. There can't be. But I also want to be really sure if I'm that judge to really dot my I's and cross my T's, you know? And so it's a really rough situation. And this idea, I really want to push back hard against this idea that Judge Cannon is basically like this, like, first year law student type person who has no clue about anything and is over her head, this knucklehead kind of ignoramus. I think that's really an unfair characterization, you know, because they say, well, she's newly appointed. But yeah, it's not like they just pulled her out of some random law school. I mean, she has. There's this narrative, I guess, that I hear a lot on the progressive left, that she's this idiot who's this just Trump sycophant who just knows nothing about the law or anything. And then just this seems kind of ridiculous to me. Again, I'm not saying that I don't think she's made some bad decisions, but I think it's been taken a little bit too far by more than a few people who are getting a lot of airplay on this.
Well, they get airplay out of Trump one way or the other, right? And I think that's, I mean, to me, the Democrats have kind of made their bet on this, and now they have to lie in it. When the primary, you know, Biden's reelection strategy seems to be, can we get this guy convicted so I can get reelected? That troubles me deeply, right?
Yeah, and
you
I think
say whether he deserves it or not, right? This whole idea of, you know, oh my gosh, democracy is on the ballot, so I'm gonna make sure we you know convict my opponent first.
But yeah, and that's one way. That's one way to look at it. It's not unreasonable. It's a very sort of I won't say partisan way of looking at it, but another way to look at it is the Biden folks are saying, listen, we want to do all these good things. We think that we know that our opponent doesn't agree with this. And what is our strongest electoral strategy? And it's about arguing that, and this is not an unreasonable argument, that somebody who has most likely, or in my view, very likely committed multiple felonies will be able to, once he is in office again, to be able to get the charges against him dismissed and basically be able to evade the law. And that, I think that should trouble anyone right?
Yeah, no, I suppose it should. But what would trouble you more? Trump getting away with, and they said getting away with, I'm not sure what that even means, right? With making a hush money payment to a porn star that she didn't hush about and now everybody knows about. Or a politicized prosecution in order to get a conviction, even when there shouldn't be one.
Yeah, and
right?
That's
again. So in the Trump case, right? Let's even assume that this is a violation. Typically, okay, it's a campaign finance violation. You know, here's your fine, whatever.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. But I agree with you on that. But I'm saying to those other cases that almost certainly will not go to trial before the election, the much more significant things, the documents thing for one, and even more significant than that, the January 6th, you know, sort of thing, which does get to the heart of a democracy, right? And so the idea that would go away is troubling, but I understand what you're saying. This is not,
there is a question. I think that presumes a legal question of, can the president pardon himself?
Well, no, I think they're.
I don't think they can, but
I don't think it's that. I think it's the question of, well, can the president get the
call
prosecution?
Off the investigation at that
exactly.
Point.
And that to me is, now there may be ways sort of around, not around that exactly. Certainly, let's say Donald Trump
imagine
wins.
The statute's longer than 4 years or something. And
well, I'm thinking in terms of, like, let's say that Donald Trump wins in November, which according to at least the most recent polling, you know, the election were held today. It's not, of course, but you could see, like, in the last days of the Biden administration, they appoint a special counsel, but then Donald Trump would just fire that. It's going to get ugly no matter what, basically. Yeah. But I guess when I think about all this in a larger context, I guess I am troubled by the Biden strategy. You know, for instance, now it seems like from everything I've been hearing, it seems more likely than not that Joe Biden will not debate Donald Trump. I don't know if I can vote for a candidate who will not debate his opponent. I have serious. Now, it's not going to matter for me in Ohio, right? I'll vote for Sherrod Brown and, you know, the other folks on the ballot, but I don't know if I can do that. I have a real problem. And so to me, this maybe gets into a larger question of voting for Trump and sort of, we've talked in the past, I've been thinking about this idea of limiting principles, right? I mean, this idea that, well, let's say you're a Republican and you are a Republican, and generally speaking, you like a lot of Donald Trump's policies, not all of them, but a lot of them, way more than Joe Biden's policies or the sort of policies you'd get. But you wouldn't, I'm guessing here, let's say Donald Trump was accused, credibly accused of mass murder, right?
Okay.
He wasn't convicted. There was an indictment. It didn't go to trial, but there was film of him shooting, you know, 20 people. Yeah. I'm betting you would say, you know what? I don't care how good the policies are. I cannot in good conscience vote for a mass murderer, right? I'm just guessing. And so obviously that's on that other end of that limiting principle. I'm not sure where that goes, but if you really believe that Donald Trump took illegal action to try to overturn the election, that he lost, that he knew he lost, I wouldn't be surprised if you felt that was on the other side of that limiting principle as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. But I guess my question is, for those people who feel that way or don't feel that way, to what extent does a trial before the election make a difference?
Right.
I mean,
that's
I think a lot of those people who say Trump committed insurrection have made up their mind. There's nothing that if a jury were to come back and say, nope, he's exonerated, he did not, I don't think they would say, I'll vote for him now. Right. I think that's baked in. Right.
It's baked in with some
decision on guilt or not guilt is different than a political decision.
It's baked in for some people, but I think for some people it does. And it should matter whether or not someone is convicted as opposed to just indicted, because as we've talked about a million times, you know, an indictment, that's just the government presenting its side of the story. And so it's easy if you only hear that one side to say, well, okay, there's enough here to have a trial, right? But to actually convict someone, that does, or at least it should, and I think it still does to a non-trivial number of people have meaning. And so in an election that is almost certainly going to be fairly close, barring something catastrophic, right, happening, that may in fact matter. And so I understand that desire to do everything within reason and within the law to make, to get a determination of this before people actually have to vote. Again, within reason and within the law, yeah. Which is not to take shortcuts.
Yeah. No, fair enough. Now, I will, two observations. I would say, I think the two federal cases you can distinguish because one, they are more serious. The Alvin Bragg, Fannie Willis, Letitia James cases, I think are fundamentally not serious. And also I'm troubled because these are people who campaigned on the promise of, I'm going to prosecute Donald Trump. I'm going to persecute your political enemies, or I don't know what, but I'll find something, right? I think that's a very dangerous idea, that we vote for people because, well, I'm going to get somebody you don't like.
In 2016, Donald Trump chanting "Lock her up" about Hillary Clinton would be another example of that.
Right. And I guess you'd point out that, did anyone prosecute Hillary Clinton? Yeah. Did anyone lock her up? No.
But I see your
point. But in this case, the chants were heard and they've come for him. My second point.
Before you get to your second point, let me just say in response to that, you and I actually have a certain amount of agreement about the two New York cases, right? The tax thing and the falsifying. They're things that in many other instances may not have gone forward or might have gone forward
as
misdemeanors.
It would be ticky-tack kind of things at best.
Now, I would say there is a distinction to be made in terms of the seriousness of the allegations when it comes to those two things and the Georgia election interference RICO sort of thing. Now, they may all be the same, and I see what you're saying here. You're arguing they're all the same in that the people prosecuting them have came to office basically arguing that they would do this sort of thing. But I think you'll agree that they're different in terms of the seriousness of the allegations and the indictments.
I would agree that the seriousness is different. Although I still don't think there's a whole lot of there right. on the
But I just wanted to make Fannie that Willis, before you got to your second point, I just wanted to make clear that distinction that you're not saying, I didn't think you were saying that all three of them were ticky-tack things. Two New York things, maybe so, but certainly if what Donald Trump is being accused of in Georgia is actually the case and what he has done, that is extraordinarily serious.
Yes, I would say that's a big claim, but I see it as with not a lot of evidentiary support.
Right.
But yeah.
Okay.
So that's, I mean, I think what my point is, there's a difference between prosecutors running on, I'm going to be tough on crime and I'm going to be tough on Trump, right? I'm going to be tough on the your political opponents. And I think that's a problem when we start saying it's not the crime we seek to prosecute, it's the person. The famous, was it Beria, Stalin's, Secret Service guy who said, look, find me the man and I'll find you the crime.
Yes and no. I see what you're saying. But I think there's also an element, if you believe that somebody is, in fact, that it's difficult to separate the man from his crimes and that the man is fundamentally criminal and has managed to evade the law, then arguing, well, I'm going to get Donald Trump would be like someone saying running for, I don't know, in prohibition times.
I'm going to get Al Capone.
Exactly.
Well,
not because he's Al Capone, but because he's a criminal who happens to have to be Al Capone. And so I'm not saying there's not an element of, well, he's our political opponent and wants to do awful things politically, and this will prevent him from doing that. But there's also, I think, an element, this is where I'm coming at it from, is saying that, well, also, there's a very good chance that he's in fact a felon and should have to pay for his crimes.
Well, right, but you've got to prosecute him for those crimes.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
It can't be the sort of postman always rings twice kind of thing, right?
Sure.
That, maybe he didn't, he did something else, and we can't prove that, so we'll get him on this.
It can't be a made up charge. It has to be something that's real and significant.
Right.
Sure, absolutely.
Right. My point would be the two New York cases, I think, are made up charges. And I think it's an even little darker thing to say, I'm going to prosecute this person because he's a terrible person. We don't want him to be in office. I think it's darker than that. I think it's, I want to prosecute this person because you, my constituents, want to see revenge against this person.
You know,
that's more troubling than to just say he shouldn't be in office.
I think that for certain elements, for certain people, there's absolutely some of that going on. But as with so many of these things, there are a lot of factors involved. I'm not saying it's not one of those factors, but I think this idea that it's just a sheer animus that's driving all of this is really oversimplified. I don't know that you're saying that.
No, and most of this stuff that wouldn't stick against a Mitt Romney, right? I mean, he invites it, but
yeah.
So my second point, we would be remiss if we didn't note the passage of O.J. Simpson. And I would point out to you, your argument that convicted felon makes a difference. I would say that O.J. is Exhibit A. I think most vast majority of people believe that O.J. did it. I believe that. Yet he was never convicted. And I believe that based on the evidence that was presented. So I think that's my point with Trump is whether he's convicted or not, I think is less of a big deal than you think it is.
Well, no, let me be clear.
Make up their own minds about the crime.
I don't actually think we disagree here. I agree with you that for the vast majority of people, you're right. But what I'm saying is that given that this is almost certainly going to be a very close election, it doesn't.
Not insignificant minority.
Exactly. So I don't think we disagree in terms of how the vast majority of the public will seize this, and they're not going to change. But if this can even change, you know, the views of, say, you know, in certain states, maybe 5,000 people, that could mean the difference between winning and losing the election. And so that's what I'm saying. And so, yeah, I don't think our disagreement is all that great here.
Yeah. And maybe I might put a further gloss on it. And it seems to be less of a do I vote for Trump or Biden? Or maybe does it just depress Trump turnout?
Yeah.
Depress Trump enthusiasm.
That could be the case as well.
I think that's more likely, right? Nobody's going to say, oh, he's a convicted felon. I'm going to vote for Biden. But they might say, do I really want to go to drive the polls to vote for that? There might be that. Yeah. I'll give you that.
And just like, I would not expect you, no matter what happens in the time, the months leading up to this election, I would not expect you to go into the voting booth on election day, because that's what you do. You go into the voting booth on election day, right?
I do. Tuesday morning, like God and James Madison.
There you go. Yes. I know for just about a certainty that you will not go in there and select Joe Biden. So the best that I can reasonably hope for is you will say, you know what? I'm just not going to vote for Donald Trump. Again, not that it's going to matter in Ohio. And I think, but that's a larger point. It's just like I can say, well, I can't in good conscience vote for a man who won't debate his opponent. But that, of course, doesn't mean I'm going to vote for Donald Trump.
Right.
So there we go.
We're a politics show telling people not to vote.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, but it is kind of a lesser. Anyway, on that note, we're not saying don't vote, folks, certainly. But anyway, but before we do go, if there's anything that Jay and I discussed on this episode that you disagreed with, my God, there's got to be something, right? Or you got a question about, we would love to hear from you. You can reach us in a bunch of ways, mail@politicsguys.com, the old school email way. Also through Facebook or X, and you'll find links in the show notes. There's our Discord discussion forum for supporters. I'm on that all the time. All kinds of interesting stuff going on there. And that is, of course, available to supporters. If you're not already a supporter, we hope you'll consider becoming one. Not only do you get the Discord access, there's a bunch of different things like ad-free versions of everything we put out, the full midweek show as opposed to just that like 15 or so minute preview. So we hope you'll check that out. Go to politicsguys.com/support or patreon.com/politicsguys, or just, you know, click on the link in the show notes. That's probably the easiest thing to do. And we do have some folks who are in a position and say, I'd love to get the full midweek show, but I just can't support you guys right now. My student loan debt relief hasn't come through yet. So just let me know. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com. I can get that set up for you. It's not a problem at all. Happy to do it. And whether you're a supporter or not, reviews, ratings on the podcast app you're using, they really do make a difference. So if you haven't done that yet, I hope you'll just take just a minute or so to do that right now. We would really appreciate it. And finally, before I go, as always, I want to give out a very special thanks to our wonderful executive producers. They are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.